Genesis chapter 4, when we left off last week, boy, things took a real bad turn, didn't they? Things were looking wonderful in chapter 3 until some really bad mistakes were made. Eve listened to Satan, Adam listened to Eve, and nobody listened to God. That sounds like a recipe for disaster to me, and it was. And things, of course, took a very, very, very bad turn down when they fell, when they sinned and disobeyed God, and he ended up pronouncing curses on all the different players in that incident, the animal world, both Adam and Eve, and so on, and we looked at those last week. And then he ended up having to run them out of the garden. There was a tree there, tree of life, and if they'd eaten from that tree in that fallen state, they could have remained in that fallen state forever. So he ran them out of there and put a guard in front of it in the form of an angel with some sort of a whirling, rotating, fiery sword that I guess if they tried to get past that guy and get back in there, it would be too bad for them. So they had to leave that environment and go on to somewhere else. And so they went east of wherever that was. And by the way, the earth's topography changes so drastically at the flood that there's no way identifying where that might have been. So anyway, wherever it was, they went out east of there. And apparently there was only like one way in, and that's where God stationed that cherubim. And they couldn't get back in. He wouldn't let them back in. So everything changed drastically. So we want to go on here this morning in chapter 4, following that event. And Moses is going to trace for us these two different lines of descent. Remember back in chapter 3, verse 15, God said, I'm going to put enmity between your seed, talking to Eve, or talking to Satan, and her seed, talking to Eve. So there will be a line of descent down from Eve that will fork into a believing line and a non-believing line. One of the lines is represented by Satan's seed and the other one by Eve's seed. And that's what Moses is going to develop for us here now as we go forward. And in chapter 4 here, he begins that. And you have a slide in your handout or a page in your handout, number 29. It looks like this. And this is going to track the names of these descendants as we go down through here. Okay, so page 29 in your handout has got these players on it. So verse 1 of chapter 4. Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, well, I've gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Now he told them to be fruitful and multiply. They didn't have any trouble obeying that part of his commandments and stuff, did they? So they got on with populating the earth, and Eve has a son whose name is Cain. The name actually means gotten. I've gotten a son, so she named him Cain or gotten. And she thinks that Cain is perhaps the fulfillment of verse 15 of chapter 3. That is, Eve will have a seed. And she thinks that maybe he's that line of descent. She doesn't know how long it's going to go on or anything yet. And so she thinks perhaps that is that, because she got him with the help of the Lord, she says. And again, she gave birth to his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of the flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. Now, Cain is kind of a chip off the old block. He's like a farmer type, like his father Adam. Where the other son, the second son, Abel, he actually managed, he's sort of animal husbandry type of guy. He raised flocks and did that sort of thing. It may be, I don't know for a fact, but it could be that Cain was maybe a little bit more of a physical guy than Abel. If you're going to work the ground, you're not going to be any too much of a wuss, are you? You're going to be a pretty strong guy, and so that may be the deal. I don't know. So we have these two sons, Cain and Abel. I have somebody in my Sunday class suggested that that's what we ought to change the name of our class to, the Cains and the Abels. And if you see people coming in and out of there, you'd understand why. But it wasn't my suggestion. It was somebody else's. All right? Any rate, we got these two guys, Cain and Abel. Verse 3, it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Remember, that's kind of where he lives. He's a farmer type. And Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offerings, but for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. So Cain became very angry and his countenance fell. What's wrong with Cain's offering? What's the nature of his offering? It's crops, isn't it? It's produce. It's a product of the ground. That's where he worked and lived and so on. And Abel's was animals. What's wrong with Cain's non-animal offering that he makes here? Do all offerings have to be the shedding of animal blood in order to be acceptable to God? Do you have a Leviticus chapter 2 in your Bible? You know, the answer is right there. No, they don't have to be all requiring the shedding of blood. Leviticus chapter 2, the big five there in the first five or six, seven chapters of Leviticus, one of those big five, number 2, is a grain offering. A grain offering was perfectly satisfactory to God. And there were some adjuncts added to that later on. There were some libations and some drink offerings and stuff like that, all of which were acceptable to God under certain circumstances. Yeah, Eddie?
Well, there was something else that I guess you could say was wrong with it too. And Abel gave the first of his flocks, but Cain brought the offering in the fullness of time. In other words, he didn't bring it from the first fruits, but as he had gathered everything in and knew how much he was going to have with anybody's.
Yeah, and that's possible too. Now, some people think that the differentiator between these two offerings has to be the fact that Abel's had the shedding of blood in it, required, or not required, but provided, and Cain's did not. But the reason I'm pointing out to you that in Leviticus chapter 2 there are sacrifices that do not require the shedding of blood is because I don't think that's the differentiator. We're told actually what the differentiator is in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 4, by faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain. What was different between these two, and the differentiator between the two, is that Cain's came not on the basis of faith, but Abel's did. Abel offered a better sacrifice than Cain. There's two kinds of people in the world, those that live by faith and those that don't. Well, so what? Can those that don't, can't they please God too? Hebrews 11, 6 says, but without faith it is impossible to please God. For he that cometh to God must believe that God is, and he's a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. You cannot please God without faith. It looks like the problem between these two boys is that Abel had already determined in his life he was going to live his life by faith. He was going to take God at his word. And Cain, he lived his life by obligation. He did what he had to try to get by, try to please God well enough that he could go on to the next phase of his life or whatever, and things didn't work out too well for him. God was not pleased with Cain. He was okay with Abel's sacrifice because Abel brought it in faith and Cain did not. So he had no regard for Cain's. And Cain got mad. His countenance fell. You could see it on his face that he was very disappointed that God accepted Abel's offering and not his. And God tries to kind of give him a chance now to sort of correct the problem when he says, look, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? That is, Cain, if you will decide to live your life by faith in obedience to my commands and so forth, you will do fine. You will be just as accepted as your brother is. But if you do not sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. God describes the situation of not repenting with his faithless attitude as sort of like an animal sitting there right by his door ready to pounce on him. Sin is like this crouching tiger. It's ready to dominate his life. And if he doesn't manage that, it's going to master him. How do you manage sin in your life? Well, there's a principle taught to us in 1 Corinthians called self-judgment. If you'll judge yourself, God will not judge you. In other words, if you will consider, and that's in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 31 and 32, if you will analyze your own life and admit to God your sins, he won't have to discipline you to get you to do that. You can do that on your own. Self-judgment. That's how you manage this. I think that's what he is kind of suggesting, at least in a roundabout way, to Cain. He needs to manage this area of sin in his life, this lack of faith, evidenced by his obligatory ritualistic sacrifice instead of one brought by faith. So God gave him the solution, but he doesn't appear to be interested in it. Well, that's what Hebrews 11:4 tells us. By faith, Abel brought a better sacrifice than Cain.
But faith in what? How did he know?
Well, in whatever God is telling him. Faith is taking God at his word. And in that chapter 11 of Hebrews is a long list of people whose lives were lived by the principle of faith. And Abel's in that list. So he chose to do that. And today, that's our choice in the world as well. We can either believe God and take him at his word and live by faith, or we can reject what he says, ignore him, and live by ourselves.
So it's pretty obvious then that Cain knew the deal and he chose not to do it. Is that right?
Well, it appears from what the Hebrew author says that, yes, they knew enough. We're not given a lot of detail of exactly what they knew about sacrificing at that point in time. But the author to the Hebrews makes it clear that that's the differentiator between the two. One of them was brought in faith and one was not. And the Abel's was.
Okay.
So there's our answer. Our answer comes a lot of books later than right here. But I think we do have that answer. So Cain is not a happy camper. So he tells his brother Abel that God wasn't pleased with him. Instead of correcting the problem, instead of repenting and thinking differently about it, he apparently harbors some sort of grudge against his brother. And it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. First generation of children after the fall has a murderer in that group, and he killed his own brother. I assume he used a rock or something like that. That's where the NRA, the National Rock Association, should have gotten in there. They should have legislated those rocks off of the face of the earth. Those mean old rocks kill people. And I'm trying to be ridiculous because I'm trying to mimic the nonsense we listen to today. He could have used a rock, he could have used a stick, he could have used his hands, who knows. The guy harbored evil in his heart enough to want to kill his brother. The tool he used is kind of irrelevant, isn't it? So Cain kills his brother. He's jealous, he's full of hatred, he's a murderer. And not only that, when the Lord confronts him with this and says, "Where's your brother?" He says, "I don't know. He's a liar too. Find me something attractive about this guy, Cain." There isn't anything attractive about him. He has fallen completely. He is totally depraved. He is not interested in repenting his attitude toward God and living by faith, as God encouraged him to do. He doesn't want the condemning presence of his brother in his life So to get rid of that condemnation, he just kills him, lies to God about it. And when God asks him, verse 10, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me on the ground. Verse 9 is where I want to pick up. He says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? He's a smart aleck on top of that. Guy doesn't have a lot of redeeming features here, does he? And God says, I hear your brother's voice crying out to me from the ground. God knew exactly what had taken place, of course. And so God curses Cain now even further in regards to the ground than Adam had been. Now you're cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you cultivate the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. You shall be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Remember, he followed his dad's footsteps. He's a farmer. And God said, now it's going to be even harder for you, Cain, to raise anything from the ground. God had already cursed the ground in general for Adam's sake because of his sin. Now he adds another layer to that, in essence says, Cain, you're going to really struggle to eke out a living from the ground. You're going to be farming in Oklahoma during a dust bowl. And Cain responds with this comment in verse 13. My punishment is too great to bear. This guy's really remorseful, isn't he? He really throws himself at the feet of God for mercy. He doesn't give a hoot about what he did to his brother. He's just now whining because he thinks God's judgment on him is too severe for him to bear. All about him. He doesn't care about anybody but himself. So that's his only response. No, well, I'm sorry I did that, or can you forgive me, or anything like that. It's just, wait a minute, you're hitting me a little too hard here, God. Behold, thou hast driven me this day from the face of the ground, and from thy face I shall be hidden, and I shall be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth, and it'll come about whenever someone finds me, he'll kill me. So he's just worried about himself. He thinks as time goes on, he'll encounter somebody, because he's got to wander around all the time. He can't live in a fortified city in a safe place or anything like that. He's got to just wander around, and he eventually encounters somebody on down the line, on down the generations, and they'll kill him. So the Lord said to him, well, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain, lest anyone finding him should slay him. So somehow or another, the Lord, I don't know if he marks him physically. That would make more sense, because how else would you know not to take vengeance on the guy if he doesn't have some sort of visual mark? Maybe he's got one of these crazy haircuts that these guys wear nowadays, huh? Look like a mohawk all the time. I don't know what he did, but somehow or another, God puts this moderating mark on him so that he wouldn't be as easily killed as he thinks there. And so that's a merciful act on God's part to kind of moderate his situation there a little bit. And then here's something that's quite instructive, verse 16. Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Did Cain want anything to do with God? No, he said, I'm out of here. I don't want to be around you. I don't want to be around a godly line that may be born as time goes on, sort of replacement from Seth, the whole right-hand column up there. I don't want to be around those kind of people. I want away from you and your requirements for faith and godliness. So I'm going to move away. And his physical movement is very much indicative of his spiritual movement. He just wants away from the righteous God that his brother served. And so he moves away. And then Moses goes on and gives us then his line of descent in the next 5, 6, 7 verses there. And he had relations with his wife. Who's that? Where'd he get that wife?
Sister.
You best not be doing that today. It's his sister, of course. There aren't any other women on the planet other than those produced by Adam and Eve. And so he's married his sister, and back in those days, that's one thing. Today, of course, you wouldn't dare do something like that, but that's where she came from. And she gave birth then to Enoch. And Enoch built a city and called the name of the city Enoch after the name of his son. He, that is Cain, built a city, called the name of the city Enoch, after the name of his son. So God told him to be that he was going to wander around. And what's he do? He goes off and tries to build a city to live in. Do just the opposite of what God tells you. That's always good. That's a good principle to live your life by. And you can see those names as we go down the line. This is the left side over here. This is the line of Satan's seed, Cain and his descendants. Now, to Enoch was born Irad, and Irad became the father of Mahujael, and Mahujael became the father of Methushael, and Methushael became the father of Lamech. See those guys coming down there? And Lamech took for himself two wives. See this line there on the left, the godless line? Not only do you have a progenitor of them being a murderer and a liar and all the other things Cain was, but they have no trouble violating God's pattern for marriage, monogamy, one woman, one man forever. So he gets two wives in defiance of anything godly. And the name of one was Ada, and the name of the other was Zillah. Always wondered if Zillah was over in the right-hand column, could we call her Godzilla? Probably not twice. You might call her that once. Any rate, Ada gave birth to Jabal, and he was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. So in that generation there, that's the eighth generation from Adam, you got guys that are ranchers, and they have tents where they can move around and that sort of thing, and so they're kind of living a bit of a nomadic lifestyle, but doing it with livestock and so on. And his brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. They've already invented musical instruments. So they're moving along pretty good, aren't they? Just because they're godless doesn't mean they're incapable. Oftentimes, you find more capability on the part of the godless than on the godly. And these guys are doing that. And as for Zillah, she gave birth to Tubal Cain. He's the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal Cain was Naamah. Now, how in the world these guys figured out how to smelt ores is beyond me, but they have. They already know how to take copper and zinc and mix the ores together, smelting them and making bronze, and they've gotten some iron ores, and they know how to process those into things too. So these guys now are metal workers. They can make swords and spears and clubs and hoes and things like that. So it didn't take long for these people to master a bunch of metal work, and that certainly changed things in a hurry, didn't it? For those that knew how to do that. And that gets us down to, that's eight generations there. Lamech, back one generation, said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, "Listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. Give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me." Lamech had killed two more people. These are not too distant relatives, of course, because they're all his relatives. And some man, and apparently a boy also, that had tried to harm him in some way, he killed them. And he says, well, if Cain is avenged sevenfold, and he knew of that somehow or another, that's one, two, three, four, five more generations later, he knew of that curse that God had put on anybody that would try to harm Cain. So he knew about that somehow. He says, look, if God's going to take vengeance on him sevenfold, then Lamech, 77-fold. I'm so much more worthy than him that I'll take vengeance myself 77 times, and more so than God would do to Lamech, or to Cain. So that line of descent you see there from Cain, the murderer, on down on the left, it's not a real attractive line, is it? Capable, though. They're not incapable. But you've got murderers. You got guys taking two wives at a time. Guys that are so haughty that they think that if God's going to take vengeance on one of their ancestors, this guy will take vengeance on it, people that would harm him 77 times what God would do. It is a godless line. Okay? God told them at the curse that he's going to put enmity between Eve's seed and Satan's seed. These people are going to be at odds against one another in life. This line is the line of Satan's seed, and you can see the character of that line. All right, Moses does a reset, and he starts over again and comes back down the other line now. We're going to go over onto the right-hand column. So Adam had relations with his wife again. Now, this is not all in strict chronological order, obviously. He's kind of jumping back now and coming down that line. And she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For she said, God hath appointed me another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. So Eve has another son, names him Abel. We talk about this driving down today. What do you think Eve thought about these sons of hers, that she had a son that murdered another of her sons? You don't get the impression that Cain could give a flip, do you? What Eve thought about him or his brothers or anybody else. He's just thinking about himself. So she thinks so that God has supplied her another son in place of Abel, whom Cain killed. And to Seth, to him was also born a son, called him Enosh. And men began to call upon the name of the Lord at that time. So on Enosh, if you take notes there, mark about Enosh there, that's when godly worship began. People start gathering together in that line, the line of descent over there on the right. Those people start kind of joining themselves together to worship God. You sort of had a formal worshiping going on. The other line's running from him as fast as they can, moving away as fast as they can, making those kind of proud and haughty statements about vengeance and so on. This line of descent, they want to get together and worship God. And it started in sort of a formal fashion there with Enosh in the third generation on the right-hand line of descent there. And then he goes on into chapter 5 and builds the line on down to Noah. That's the point he's trying to get to here. So he says in chapter 5, verse 1, this is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day in which God created man, he made him in the likeness of God, and he created him male and female. He blessed them and named him man in the day that they were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and he became the father of a son in his own likeness, 130-year-old, before he had his first son. Now remember, they lived about 10 times longer than we do today. But still, that's kind of... seems to me like that's catching on kind of slow, isn't it? Maybe I'm wrong. But at any rate, Adam's 130 years old. And by the way, you have another chart that looks like this that shows you the ages of the patriarchs, the year of their birth, the year of the next patriarch's birth, and then the year of their death. And if you'll subtract this column from this column, you'll get their age, if you care. Or you can ask me and I'll just tell you, since I've already done that for you. So at any rate, page 30 gives you some of the chronology of these guys. So at 130 years in, Adam had Seth. And they had other sons and daughters mentioned there in verse 4. That's where the wives, of course, are coming from. So all the days of Adam were 930 years, and he died. 930 years. Can you imagine that? A little hard to imagine from our reference today, isn't it? Remember that environment we talked about that we think was kind of like a greenhouse? With probably even temperatures and... a lot of blockage of the sun's destructive rays. Long lives during that period, I think, caused by that. Are you warm, Kathy? Oh. Walter, tweak that down just a tad, if you would, please. So the environment back then, I think, was conducive to these long lives. We don't have that today. We have all kinds of different stuff going on. So But back then they had these very, very long lifespans. And he died, and he had a son in his own likeness. Remember we talked before what the likeness of God was all about? And how that is transmitted, we think, through natural birth, through the father. Adam had a son whose likeness was like his own. So he has God's likeness, and he in turn passes that on to his son, and he passes it on to his son, apparently through the father, because the Lord could not have an earthly father which had a sin nature. He could have an earthly mother, and did, but if it is passed through the father, that's why Joseph could not be his earthly father. So that's why we think that. Makes sense anyway. And he died. Verse 5. Remember what God told him? In the day that you eat of this tree, you will surely die. Well, was he wrong by 930 years? No, the physical death and spiritual death both that applied to Adam took place spiritually immediately, but it took a little while for the physical death to come around, but it finally has here, and he died. So Seth lived 105 years, and he became the father of Enosh. Then Seth lived 807 years after he became the father of Enosh, and he had other sons and daughters too. So Seth lived a whopping 912 years. All the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. Starting to see a trend here between these guys, isn't it? And he died, and he died, and he died. So Enosh lives 90 years, and he became the father of Kenan. Then Enosh lived 815 years after he became the father of Kenan, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. And Kenan, it may be the Canaan up here you're seeing on this chart, just a different spelling. He lived 70 years and became the father of Mahaliel. Kenan lived 840 years after he became the father of Mahaliel, and he had other sons and daughters. All the days of Kenan were 910 years, and he died. Then Mahaliel lived 65 years, and he became the father of Jared. Then Mahaliel lived 830 years after he became the father of Jared, and he had other sons and daughters. All the days of Mahaliel were 895 years, and he died. And Jared lived 162 years, and he became the father of Enoch. Then Jared lived 800 years after he became the father of Enoch, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. And Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. There's a biblical name that most people recognize, isn't it? Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. He's just a youngster. Then Enoch walked with God, for he was not, for God took him. Enoch did not experience physical death like everybody else, did he? God translated Enoch. Enoch walked with God. They were hand in hand. God was very pleased with Enoch. Enoch was another man of faith, a man who had chosen to live his life by faith. And after 365 years, God just took him on home into heaven. Now, some people think that because he never died physically, he's got to come back to earth to die. And they think that he is one of the two witnesses of Revelation 11. Maybe. Doesn't have to be that, but he could be, I suppose. Can't prove that he isn't. But at any rate, he is unique in this line in that he was translated without experiencing physical death. So Methuselah lived 87 years, and became the father of Lamech. This is another Lamech now, not the one we saw earlier, but it's a different Lamech. So then Methuselah lived 782 years, and he became the father of Lamech, and he had other sons and daughters. All the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. Numero uno on the age parade was Methuselah, 969 years. By the way, his name, some people think, means when he dies, it will come. What came when he died?
The flood.
So it may be that his name reflected some event here that's we're gonna see in just a little bit, and it was the universal flood. So Lamech lived 100, I'm in verse 28 now. Lamech lived 182 years, and he became the father of a son. Now the name of his son was Noah, saying, "This one shall give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands rising from the ground which the Lord has cursed." So Noah's name actually was sort of prophetic in that they thought there would be some relief from the curse at the time of Noah. There's certainly going to be a change in things at that time. So Lamech lived 595 years after he became the father of Noah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So Noah has three sons now that are mentioned in this genealogy. Everybody in this room has a common father in Adam and in Noah. Everybody on the planet has those two common fathers. Now, you could be from Shem, you could be from Ham, or you could be from Japheth, depending on your ancestry and so on and so forth. But Noah is a common point for all of us, as was Adam. So this gets us down now in Moses' trailing of the chasing of the people here now to the time frame of Noah, which is where he's trying to get here. Now it came about, we're going into chapter 6 here, it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them. Let me just show you something that's of interest here. This chart here, which is your page 31, has on it a simple mathematical progression. And it just takes the assumption, well, after you get a few generations going, that there were 16 children born in each generation. And those, they're the kind of numbers that you see grow out of just that kind of an assumption. Not trying to say what the population of the world was at this time. Depending on the assumptions you make, it could easily have been like what we have today. Several billion. But just a simple little assumption here of 16 children per generation, by the time you get down to Noah, you're talking multiple millions of people. And as I say, depending on what assumptions you want to make, you can get up into the billions. So the big idea here is that the world population, by the time this Noah circumstance happens, it's big, big numbers, lots of people, probably numbering at least in the hundreds of millions, maybe a few billion, something like that. So it's not some kind of 20 or 30 or 40 people were living over here in this one little area and it got rained on real hard and they all drowned. This is a worldwide issue or event that's going to take place, and there's tons and tons and tons of people involved, easily in the hundreds of millions. So just kind of keep that in mind as we walk on down through here. So Moses tells us that as the world population grew, the sons of God, verse 2, saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Well, now, who in the world are these people? Who are the sons of God and the daughters of men? Well, there's two prominent viewpoints, the right one and the wrong one. Actually, this is so about evenly divided, we probably aren't going to even come up with right or wrong. About half of the believers that you encounter, good men that you would rely on and trust, think that the daughters of men here were the product of cohabitation between fallen angels and women on the planet at this time. That answers that somewhat mysterious reference there in 2 Peter 2:4 and Jude 6 about angels who kept not their first estate. God has locked them into the pit until the day of judgment. So half of the community thinks that, well, these are angels that have cohabitated with women and have produced these daughters of men that are the result of that kind of cohabitation. And that the godly line, these guys from this line over here, then began to intermarry with them and were corrupted by that angelic event. Now, The positive aspect of that is it does explain those passages that I mentioned there to you, 2 Peter 2:4 and Jude 6. That would be an explanation for them then if that was indeed what happened. But it introduces a bunch of problems. It makes it just as difficult to figure out as if that wasn't the answer. How in the world do angels propagate through earthly women? They have no reproductive organ. They have no DNA. They're spirits. The only way that's possible is they have to occupy a man and use his body to do this. They have to possess some man and reproduce normally, in a normal physical way, to produce any kind of offspring. And if they do that, how is it that the DNA and the chromosomes from the male is altered to produce these so-called mighty men, these Nephilim mentioned here in verse 4. They were on the earth in those days also. Afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, and they were the mighty men who were men of old, men of renown. So it creates some genetic problems, to say the least, some biology issues to try to figure it out if that was the case. If this involves some sort of angelic activity, there's a whole bunch of other issues that you got to try to find some way of explaining. Usually the best explanation is the simplest. And the simplest explanation is very simply that these guys and these guys simply intermarried. You have the godly line of descent, started worshiping God and kind of collectively there under Enosh, you have the godly line of descent intermarrying with the godless line of descent. And remember that throughout Israel's history, God warned him of that over and over and over again. He says, when you get into that promised land that I'm going to take you to, do not intermarry with those godless peoples around you, those Canaanites. They will corrupt your thinking and turn your heart away from me. Did they do that? Did they follow his command? Solomon had like 600 or 700 wives. And they turned his heart from God. The smartest guy that ever walked on the planet wasn't all that smart when it came to women. He let them turn his heart from God. They were godless women. And God warned him over and over and over again about that. So I think the best explanation, the easiest explanation, although there are godly men on both sides of this, you can find people that you really have confidence in and so on who think it is the angelic explanation. But it looks to me like maybe it's just simply a matter of these two lines intermarried with one another and were corrupted. The evil corrupted good. Don't be deceived. That's the normal principle. Evil will corrupt good. You drop a white glove into a mud puddle, the mud puddle doesn't become clean. The white glove gets muddy. Evil will corrupt good. And I think that's all he's saying here. That's probably is what happened. And that will explain then how it is that this entire race of mankind, millions and perhaps hundreds of millions, became so corrupted that God says, I can't stand this anymore. He told him in verse 3, he's going to give him another 120 years, and then he's going to deal with it. The Lord saw in verse 5 that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Man, can you look at those superlatives there. Every intent was only evil continually. There is nothing going on the entire planet that is righteous in nature. Everything, every thought, every intent of the entire human race, with one small exception here, was continuously evil. Can you get your mind around that? What would the world be like, I wonder, today if the Holy Spirit wasn't here restraining sin through the church and through you and I? Would it be any different, you think? I doubt it'd be any different. It'd be the same way, probably. And when the Holy Spirit changes his ministry at the rapture, it's just inconceivable how how evil this planet is going to become almost instantaneously. Well, that's what's happened here. And God was sorry that he made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, I'm going to blot man out, whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals, to creeping things, to birds of the sky, for I'm sorry that I have made them. God is going to do a redo. He's going to do it over. And he's going to wipe out all of the life on the planet, with this exception, verse 8, Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. What did Noah do that pleased God? He lived by faith. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Noah was a man of faith. He took God at his word, as we'll see here. Now, these are the records of the generation of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blessed in his time. Noah walked with God. Hebrews 11, 7 points that out. And he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The world was corrupt. And God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. All flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. It looks like in verse 12 it's telling us that it is all flesh that corrupted mankind, not angels, that they corrupted each other, that it was a human tragedy, not an angelic one, like the other camp thinks. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them, and behold, I'm about to destroy them with the earth. So he tells Noah to make himself a source of protection here, an ark in verse 14. Going to make it out of gopher wood. I suspect that's something like cypress or something that can handle the water really well, and those trees were probably growing in that area. And here's how you should make it. You should make it 300 cubits by 50 cubits by 30 cubits. The dimensions are 3 by 5 by 30. Okay. You see this stick, this board? Can you see that thing? This is cut to the exact dimensions of the ark in relative proportion. That's the way the ark would look if you can imagine it being 450 feet long instead of a few inches. Okay, that's the proportion of the dimensions. Now remember, the thing will sit in the water probably up to about halfway up this side here. It had to be, the water had to get 25 feet above Mount Ararat in order for this thing to float over it. So it's sitting in the water probably about half of that side right there, halfway up. So can you imagine that thing turning over? I mean, what's going to turn that thing over? It's just a floater. It's nothing. It ain't got a rudder. God's the rudder. It has no hydrodynamic characteristic to it at all. It's just to float along is all it's supposed to be. And so that's what the thing, there's a picture back there in that book if you want to look at it, but that's the relative dimensions of it there. Just float is all it's supposed to do. So God told him to go build this thing. Oh, and by the way, 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. And you shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit above the top and set a door in the side of the ark. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. So it's supposed to have three decks built into this thing and some kind of a top here with a window around it. Why would they need that? Would you want a window if you had a floating zoo in your midst? Yeah, you'd want a little ventilation, wouldn't you? And some light. It wouldn't hurt to have some light either. So the opening around the top apparently is for both lighting and ventilation. And that sucker is going to hold the animal world and Noah and his family. So he tells him to go build that thing. And I am going to, verse 17 he says, bring a flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish. But I'll establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you, a whopping total of 8 people out of multi-hundreds of millions, 8 whole people. Got a big door built in the side in verse 16. One way in, one way out. Can you think of an analogy that that door might be for? I am the way. The Lord said he was the door of the fold. You don't get in the sheepfold other than going through him. You don't get into heaven other than going through him. I expect that door was left open, and I know it was left open, to right up to the end. It's probably a ramp. If anybody else had changed their mind and wanted in, I suspect they could have gotten in. But nobody did. Just eight people. And with every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female, birds after their kind, animals after their kind, creeping things. They shall come to you, verse 20. He didn't have to go out and round up all these critters. It'd take him the rest of his life, probably, wouldn't it? No, they came to him. God brought the animals to him. And as for you, you take for yourself some of all food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and shall be food for you and for them. So he's laying a bunch of stores of food, both animal and people food. Thus Noah did according to all that God had commanded him, so he did. Pretty impressive guy, huh? God just gives him a building project that's unimaginably hard and huge and difficult, telling him that he's going to protect him from something that he had never seen before and didn't know anything about, rain. And for 120 years, this guy gets up every morning, packs his lunch, and heads out to the build site, building this monster of a construction item to protect him and his family from something that he didn't know a thing about. That's faith, isn't it? Taking God at his word. Noah did what God told him to do. He didn't say, well, God, could you give me a little more detail and explain to me how this is all going to come about? Because I don't know what the heck you're talking about. What's this rain stuff you're talking about? And why does this have to be so big? 120 years of dropping trees and splitting those suckers up, everything by hand. There weren't any too many chainsaws and mills around to run this lumber through. All of that massive amount of work for 120 years, this man just kept right on plugging. Noah chose to live his life by faith, didn't he? And that faith was what made him righteous, as Hebrews 11:7 says. Noah achieved the righteousness which is by faith. So there's a very good example of living by faith. We'll knock off here because we ain't got time to get into the flood. So far, what we've seen is that these two lines of descent from Adam include a seed of Satan over here, the godless line on the left, and the seed of Eve, the godly line over here. And in the course of time, the two lines mesh together. They intermarried with one another, and the godless line corrupted the godly line. Is, I think, the right explanation. It could be that angelic thing, but I think this is the right explanation. And it got so bad that by the time, this is like 1,650 years down from Adam, the world was so bad that God had to wipe out everybody on it and start over. In 1,650 years, it was so thoroughly corrupted that there's only eight people on the planet that God would save. It's just kind of, it blows the mind, doesn't it? Now, we see and try to comprehend evil today in various forms, and it gets pretty bad at times. But man, this is hard to get your mind around. Of all of those millions, there's only eight people? That's what God has told us. So the fall of humanity by Adam and Eve has led to just immeasurable harm and destruction to the human race. Up to this point, and then it kind of starts over again, and then we're right on the same path again. And it's going to be pretty much the same thing in Revelation 6 through 19. Those judgments that are going to come are going to produce a similar, not quite as much of a death rate, because it's only eight people, but a pretty bad death rate. So it's hard to really grasp the nature of sin and its effect. The depravity of man, how thorough it is, how extensive it is, it's just hard to grasp till you read stories and things like this. All right, any questions or comments about anything we saw here? Bill?
How many actual people do you think are actually working on the barge
I guess it was just him and his sons, and you know, occasionally daughters come down and help a little bit or something. I guess they didn't have any other help. They might could have rustled up a little bit from time to time from somebody that would just help. But I think it was a project that was done by just a handful of folks as compared to putting thousands of people out there working on it. God told him, build this for yourselves. So I doubt that there was too much other involvement other than him and his family. Be sure and check that picture out back there on that book as you go past. Just kind of gives you a little bit of idea of the clutter inside and what all had to be done. And we're not through yet. We'll work our way through the flood next time. But we've got the race so corrupted that there's a need for the flood is what Moses has traced for us here in these chapters this morning. Anything else anybody want to mention? All righty. We'll let you roll. You'll have a good week, and we'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing.